In the news.
Hello, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. It's been
a big week, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of things going on. So today we're going to discuss the end of the Republican National Convention, and then we'll talk about the early days of the Democratic National Convention. Then we'll move more to specific policy issues, specifically what we're seeing in regards to the Obama administration and health insurance companies. Also, the court's ruling regarding the Texas voter ID laws, considering this is campaign season and some of the complexities with that.
And my gold medal picks for the upcoming Olympics.
That's right. All right. So again, Rio is only a few weeks away. Don't drink the water. All right.
Please don't go.
Yeah. So let's start off with the RNC. We talked about it a little bit last week, specifically focusing on kind of the gaffe you had with the plagiarism of a speech, but, you know, these things happen. But there's still some more controversy. And really the big controversy was with our own Senator Ted Cruz and his unwillingness to endorse Donald Trump. So let's roll that clip.
To protect our God-given rights, even of those with whom we don't agree, so that when we are old and gray, and when our work is done, and we give those we love one final kiss goodbye, we will be able to say, freedom matters, and I was part of something beautiful. The case we have to make to the American people, the case each person in this room has to make to the American people, is to commit to each of them that we will defend freedom and be faithful to the Constitution. We will unite the party, we will unite the country by standing together for shared values, by standing for liberty. God bless each and every one of you, and God bless the United States of America.
So when you say God bless, and everybody figures out he's done, and he has not endorsed the nominee, that's when you get the cascade of boos. So there's a little bit of a, you know, an irony or an interesting juxtaposition here between the Republican and the Democratic conventions in that, you know, Ted Cruz got booed for not endorsing Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders and others got booed for endorsing Hillary Clinton. So I'm not quite sure what you can do as a losing candidate to come off very well. But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was also the timing is a little bit weird because I think this was on the third day before the convention, whereas the Democrats, they got all that out the first day. And so it was kind of weird, like we're going along. Oh, Ted Cruz is coming. So this is kind of seen as, okay, let's finally get the unity going. Then Ted Cruz doesn't do it. I mean, again, he makes a speech and clearly he's pivoting for 2020 or 2024. But it's clear he wanted to stand out with his speech.
Well, you know, look, I'll let you in on a little bit of inside baseball here. I mean, a lot of this is floor management, right? So what you see in the Republican convention, right, as Professor McDaniel mentioned, this is day three that Ted Cruz is speaking to the convention crowd. I think it was day three. It might have been day two, but I think it was day three. And at that point, you know, the Kasich supporters, all 15 of them, the Cruz supporters have basically left. There's not that many of them to begin with. The place is dominated by supporters of the nominee, you know, Donald Trump. So the place is crackling with people who have an allegiance and affinity for Donald Trump. And so Ted Cruz gets up there and gives, you know, what he and his supporters probably think is an intellectually honest speech, you know, saying vote your conscience as opposed to, you know, vote for Donald Trump. And that's just not going to go over very well. On the Democratic side, the problems they had on Monday morning, the first day of the speech, were because the Sanders supporters had kind of worked their way down to the front of the stadium in Philadelphia, the arena in Philadelphia, and were, you know, protesting and yelling and getting a lot of airtime. By Monday night, by the time Michelle Obama and others spoke, those people had been cleared out. They had been induced, cajoled, use your verb of preference or choice, but they'd gotten them the heck off of center stage, moved them up a little bit, so that by the time the primetime speeches were on, speeches between, you know, I guess 7 o'clock Central Time and 9 o'clock Central Time, they were kind of out. So I think the floor management dynamics are as important here as anything else. There's a lot of talk, and we'll get into this, about the Democratic convention, about how, you know, the delegates were turned by the words of Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama gave a wonderful speech. You don't convince Bernie supporters, you know, hey, you know what? I really do like Hillary. That did not happen. What happened was mechanically those people were moved to the rafters, so they weren't going to mess up the Democrats' optics on the Monday night, you know. But yeah, I love persuasion in speeches, but let's be real here. So anyway, the Cruz speech, I don't know, you know, to Professor McDaniel's point about 2020 or 2024, I don't think that speech hurts him in Texas. You know, I don't think it really does much damage to him nationally. In fact, if Trump goes down in flames, you know, people might look back on that kind of favorably. He stood up before a convention and refused to endorse a guy he didn't believe in, and, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, and the issue is this isn't part of the problem he has is that people have been arguing that Trump is not a true conservative. And Ted Cruz is really saying, look, to really move this nation forward, there are certain ideals we need to uphold. And these are the ideals I'm going to uphold. Donald Trump may not uphold them as well as I would like, so I can't endorse them. But then there's also a personal part about this. I mean, the man went after his wife and his father, and then
and his kids.
Yeah. And so it got personal. You know, it wasn't, you know, like, Ted, I don't like you. It was, Ted, I don't like you. I don't like your wife. I don't like your kids. I don't like your daddy. I don't like your dog. I don't like your dog's mom. I mean, it got, like, real personal. And that's, and the problem was, instead of Trump kind of backing down from that, after all of this, he reiterated, yeah, I think his dad killed JFK. It was like, no, like, just let it go. And that became kind of that was a big issue. And, I mean, and, you know, and Ted Cruz made it clear, I'm not going to be bullied into this. I'm not going to support somebody who goes after my family. You know, so think of him as the Liam Neeson of the Republican Party.
Yeah, it's you know, it's sort of a fascinating dynamic. You don't see it very often. It's kind of funny. I heard a line that I thought was pretty good, which is, you know, typically we think of these conventions as being, you know, reality TV. But, of course, they're not. They're sort of prepackaged and planned. By the way, I don't have a problem with that. You know, I don't think it's ridiculous every 4 years to allow the political parties to make their case directly to the American people. I don't have a fear of being manipulated. The parties are communicating. They're trying to put on their best face. Doesn't bother me that that's happening. But that prepackaged element and sort of veneer to these conventions, which has been dominant really for the last 30, 40 years, this one really was a reality show. You know, I don't think Trump's people had a, you know, tight control over it. I don't know how you have tight control over Trump anyway. I was stunned during his speech, which we'll get to in a second, that he was able to actually read the speech. I just assumed he was going to go rogue 3 or 4 or 5 times over the course of that thing. So, you know, I guess kudos to him for doing that. But, you know, I don't know. People, I don't know if they objected, but people sort of commented about it was rough and there's this sort of Wild West element to it. It's funny, that's what the networks are always clamoring for, but when they get it, they talk about how it's evidence that, you know, there's dissension. Well, of course there's dissension and lack of control. And, you know, so I don't know. Watching the Democratic Republican conventions, it sort of strikes me that you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you're too controlled, they don't like that. If, you know, you're kind of rough around the edges and things happen, you know, well, that's not good either. You know, who knows?
Well, it's like when Geraldo had that fight on his show. Everybody condemned it, but then everybody started watching Geraldo.
They watched it. And the numbers for the Trump speech were off the charts. It's the most, you know, viewed convention speech in history. My guess is it'll get more eyeballs than Hillary Clinton's speech will this coming week, even though that'll be a well-watched speech as well. You know, it was something. So we do have some clips of the Donald,
yes,
or clip of the Donald speech. So
here are some excerpts from Donald Trump's speech.
AI take the oath of office, Americans will finally wake up in a country where the laws of the United States are enforced.
Donald Trump had delegates to the Republican National Convention on their feet, roaring in an emotional speech pitched as much to the audience at home as those in the arena.
USA, USA, USA.
Trump laid out a laundry list of things he wants to do, but first things first, he said he wants to make people feel safe and the crime and violence on our streets.
Beginning on January 20th, of 2017, safety will be restored.
That's the day the next president takes the oath of office. And when Trump stressed safety, he also meant safety from terrorism. He blamed Democrat Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, for the spread of ISIS.
After 4 years of Hillary Clinton, what do we have? Death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness. Let's defeat her in November.
Trump offered a plan to protect the nation from terrorism.
We must have the best, absolutely the best gathering of intelligence anywhere in the world. We must work with all of our allies who share our goal of destroying ISIS and stamping out Islamic terrorism and doing it now.
I don't know if that's actually a plan for safety or defeating ISIS, but, you know, gathering intelligence and working with allies, I guess that's sort of the broad contours of a plan. So Trump's the law and order candidate.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting to watch the two conventions side by side or, you know, back to back and see the different emphases, right? The Republicans, so Trump in particular, talked about, I'm the law and order candidate. I'm going to defend you from ISIS, right? Sort of intuiting that this is sort of the top thing that people are concerned about. This is what the focus needs to be in the campaign. Whereas if you watch the Democratic convention, I think on Monday night, and Trump tweeted this, you know, there was not a single mention of ISIS. You know, the Democratic convention has been mostly about bringing people together, moving forward together. The country's not in that bad a shape. So it's two very different tones to this. And the main criticism of Trump's speech in the Republican convention that I discerned was that it was too dark, that it was too negative. It sort of painted a picture of America in crisis, and, you know, that disturbed some of the pundits or people who thought that that wouldn't work well or would not resonate with voters. But I guess it's a matter of interpretation, right? I mean, who's got a better sense? Who's got their finger on the pulse of the country right now? Is it the Republicans and Trump who, you know, are counting on the fact that people are afraid, people are kind of angry, people are not happy? Or is it the Democrats who seem to think that, well, you know, there's some anxiety, but mostly people think we're moving in the right direction and they're offering, you know, kind of a more optimistic take on how things are going?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to that, the thing about it is, if the Democrats, they want to say, no, things are going well because you had a Democratic president in office. So if they're like, oh, God, the world's gone to hell, then it's like, but he was the president of your, he was the president was from your party, so that means it's your fault. So you can't really say, it's like, no, things are going well, you know, whereas if you want change, you do that. So if you think about Obama in 2008, I mean, he was very critical. Like, here's what we're doing wrong here, here's what we're doing wrong in all these different places. You know, whereas I think McCain was still critical because he wasn't part of the administration, but he also wasn't going to, you know, say, oh, no, we're all going to hell in a handbasket. And so part of it is, you know, when you want to bring a new party in, you got to make the old party look horrible. And this makes sense. And again, there are probably going to be disagreements between Obama and Clinton on a lot of things. We're seeing with the TPP, there are differences there. But for the most part, it's like, we're heading in the right direction, and I'm going to keep that going. You saw the same thing with Gore in 2000, and you saw the same thing with Bush 1 after Reagan, that, you know, the idea that we're going to keep things going. I think things are going well, whereas everybody else is preaching gloom and doom. However, I think we could argue that Trump is a little more heavy-handed in his gloom and doom than others have been in the past.
I think that's right. Just a couple points. The first is, you know, if we're talking about historical analogies, the one that I kept thinking of is 1968. And people talked about, you know, this summer as being in some ways analogous to 1968. I don't think it's, you know, quite that revolutionary, apologies to Bernie Sanders, But, you know, in 1968, you had Hubert Humphrey running as kind of the heir to the Johnson administration, which had, you know, these sort of terrific domestic policy successes, you know, an active civil rights record, but was handling an unpopular war. Johnson wasn't running for re-election. Humphrey was kind of the heir to the throne. And Richard Nixon came along and was talking about being the representative of the silent majority and the law and order candidate, you know, and so was appealing directly to those sorts of voters who were uncomfortable with, you know, these sorts of rebellions in the streets, riots, you know, actions against the police, you know, the disorder that a lot of people thought was going on. So I don't know, 68 strikes me as being kind of interesting. And that, of course, turned out to be an extremely close election with Nixon just, you know, edging Humphrey by a point and a half. We may be headed kind of in a direction like that. On the notion of sort of points and, you know, margins, I would point out that the preliminary polling evidence suggests that Trump got a modest but a statistically real bounce. You know, it's not just noise in the polls. He did seem to get a bump from his convention, bump meaning an increase in his standing in the polls. It's not clear exactly, you know, where the race is right now. Everybody shows that Trump improved his standing, but some of those polls, for instance, show that he was down 8 and now he's tied. Well, that's a bump, but you're tied and the Democrats haven't had their chance yet. Others showed he was down 2 or 3 and now he's up 2 or 3, which again is a bump that actually takes him into the lead. You know, my guess, reading an aggregation of the polls, is that Trump's up a point or two right now, but I think that's meaningless until the end of the Democratic convention when Hillary's had her chance and we can kind of see where the race stands. You know, I think that race will probably be pretty much frozen. So beginning next week, when you see polls coming out, if they show Hillary up a couple points, I think you can probably take it to the bank that she's going to be up a point or two on Labor Day, which is when the real general election campaign begins. Same with Trump. If Trump is up, that race will probably be frozen, you know, because the Olympics are happening, football starts, school starts, people pay a little less attention to politics. The candidates themselves aren't as active, right? So I think that's probably the state of the race. One last comment, though, about, you know, what Professor McDaniel mentioned is exactly right with respect to the Democrats painting this sort of rosier picture. You know, traditionally we think of the kind of campaign that Hillary Clinton's going to run has been, again, to use a historical analogy, compared to the Morning in America campaign that Ronald Reagan ran when he was running for re-election in 1984, right? That we had turned the corner, things were going well, and it was important to stay the course, to consolidate the gains that had been made. You know, I've got a little bit of a question about whether that works for Democrats as well as it does for Republicans. There's something about the Democratic Party, its coalition, the elements of that party, which include racial and ethnic minorities, you know, people with disabilities, people of different sexual orientations. That coalition, I think, is less amenable, less receptive to the argument that things are going great. You know, we've turned the corner. Everything is fine. America is wonderful. There's something, you know, the Republican Party seems more comfortable with that kind of rhetoric than the Democratic Party, which oftentimes has involved putting together a coalition of people who, you know, have historically been disadvantaged. So I wonder about a, you know, a Morning in America campaign, you know, when your coalition really has serious grievances still with, you know, the way things have gone historically in the United States. That's a speculation on my part, but I think it's kind of be kind of interesting to watch this play out.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one way you can interpret it is it could be worse, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah, keep us here or it gets worse. It's not great now, but it could be much worse if, you know, Trump gets, and that's kind of the rhetoric people are going with. It's, you have a bunch of people, I guess they mentioned how many times Hillary Clinton's name was mentioned, you know, not Trump, but during the RNC. It was like, okay, yeah, he may not be the best, but at least he's not Hillary Clinton. And I think Hillary Clinton a lot of times is trying to win over the Bernie supporters by saying, hey, I'm not Trump. But we'll have to see how this all plays out. Now, moving on to the DNC, we got some important news this week. Hillary Clinton picked her vice presidential candidate.
Who was it?
It was Kane.
Kane?
That's right. And so as we see pictured here, this is what I originally thought it was when I thought it was, I thought it was Hillary Clinton and Big Daddy Kane.
That would have been a bold pick.
That's
a bold pick, Cotton.
That's what I was hoping for. So, well, those of you who aren't familiar with Big Daddy Kane, let me give you a little bit of taste of what your vice president should have been.
Aw, yeah.
with this. I'm just gonna sit here laid back to this nice mellow beat, you know, and drop some smooth lyrics. Cause it's 88, time to set it straight, you know what I'm saying? And there ain't no half-stepping. Word, I'm ready.
Rappers stepping to me, they wanna get some, but I'm the cane, so yo, you know the outcome. I'm not the victory, they can't get with me. So pick a BC day, cause you're history.
That was when I was in college, when life was good.
Yes, yes. No.
We were wrong.
She chose Tim Kaine. So who is Tim Kaine, you ask? Well, I have some information for you. So he's a former governor of Virginia, and he is currently in the Senate representing Virginia. Now, Kaine sticks out because he's never lost an election. So he's undefeated in political campaigns.
Neither is Trump, as it turns out.
Well, we won't mention when he ran in 2012. But one of the things about him that hurts him is that he is not a darling of the extreme left. So Bernie Sanders supporters weren't so happy about him because he's much more moderate. Furthermore, he's showing tepid support for the TPP, but has actually backed off of that. And he's not been so supportive of regulating banks, specifically the small banks and credit unions. And so because of that, because of his Wall Street ties, he's been questioned. But in addition to that, He's much like Joe Biden in the sense that he's talked about he's personally opposed to abortion. And as governor of Virginia, he actually put some laws in place to try to not necessarily make abortions more difficult, but medical procedures. He did abstinence only sex education, but removed that when he found that studies found that it was not effective. Since he's been in the Senate, though, he has actually been very supportive of pro-choice. Yeah, I'm trying to remember the groups. it shows you how early I got up this morning. The pro-choice group. So he's actually been very liberal on that, even though he's personally against that. Also, he's opposed to the death penalty. And that was one of the big things when he was running for governor, is he said, I'm opposed to the death penalty, but there were still 11 executions while he was governor. It did not stop that. He said, look, I'm here to uphold the law. I will uphold the law. And so because of that, he's kind of an interesting figure. People painted him as being boring. Hillary Clinton said, that's good. And given the controversy she's had, boring, ooh, tastes fabulous right now.
Yeah, I think the contrast between Kaine and Trump, I think, is what she's going after. You know, it used to be that vice presidential candidates were almost exclusively chosen because of their state affiliations, right? The idea was John Kennedy chose Lyndon Johnson because he thought Johnson would help him carry Texas, which he did. You know, this was in fact the case up until probably, I think 1992 might be the year in which it really changed, when Bill Clinton, who was a young Southern kind of moderate governor, chose Al Gore, who at that point, before he started growing a beard and traveling on Southwest Airlines, was also a young, moderate Southern governor. And so instead of, you know, from Tennessee, going for someone to balance the ticket or bring a particular state, he doubled down on, you know, his calling card, his credentials as president, right? George W. Bush picked Dick Cheney from the, you know, awesomely powerful state of Wyoming, no offense to my Wyoming friends out there, in 2000. It wasn't to bring Wyoming into the fold. It was because Cheney brought gravitas, experience in foreign policy, you know, that Bush needed when he was running for president. So here, now this is a little bit of a throwback in the sense that I think Hillary does want help in Virginia. It's a key battleground state. Kaine is popular in Virginia. I'm a little skeptical that Kaine helps her carry Virginia. I think she either carries Virginia or loses it on her own. But that is certainly a plus. There's a little bit of strategic insight, as Professor McDaniel suggested here. If she'd have gone with Big Daddy Kaine, that's a roll of the dice, right? That suggests, you know, she wants to mobilize a group, appeal to millennials or Gen Xers. Gen Xers, actually.
Yeah, people who were big in the 80s, 80s right. Hip-hop.
Yeah. But she doesn't do that. She goes with the sort of white, moderate, you know, popular governor. So to me, that reveals she's pretty confident about where she stands. Right, she didn't go with the Julian Castro, you know. She didn't go with an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders. You know, it seems to me that her reading of the race right now is she's got a little bit of a lead. She's going to play it safe. She's going to play it conservative. You know, and by the way, I think that's probably an accurate read on the race. Although, if email drops keep coming out, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a second because, oh, what a way to make a mess out of this.
Do we want to go to Debbie?
We'll go to Debbie in a second, but I guess one thing I want to point out is everybody was upset about not bringing in Elizabeth Warren and others like that. Is one of the things you have to realize is that Elizabeth Warren is kind of the person on the loudspeaker yelling and screaming, sending out these tweets at Trump, kind of the progressives. If she moves to become vice presidential candidate, well, the problem is she moves into the administration. And in many ways, that actually muzzles her because she has to work with the administration. So because she can stand on the outside and yell, and I mean, people like her because she can stand outside and yell and scream, but the problem is if she moves into the administration, she can't do that anymore because now she has to uphold the administration. And so you have to understand there's a trade-off here. Furthermore, you don't want to pull people out that have powerful positions that can help you get things done in Congress. So you don't want to take somebody who's making the deals, everything like that, out because who's going to replace them? And so there's a strategy there in terms of, okay, who would be a good vice presidential pick, but also, you know, who can I pull out of Congress that does not weaken the strength of my party or my ability to get things done when I'm in there? So it's a strategic thing, but then also, those of you who like Elizabeth Warren and like what Elizabeth Warren is doing, you don't want her to become vice president because she can't do those things anymore.
Right, Professor McDaniels, he's a policy guy, I'm an elections guy. He's talking about the policy implications of getting Warren out of the Senate, for instance, into a VP position. I'll go with the political side of that, which is you're forfeiting a Democratic seat. Now, it's Massachusetts. They probably elect a Democrat, this Democratic governor, Republican governor at this point in Massachusetts. So it would be a Republican replacing Elizabeth Warren, and then that person would have a leg up. So you're losing a seat in the Senate, and there's a close battle for the Senate right now. You know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren speeches on Monday night at the convention, which we'll talk about here in a second, you know, were very interesting, and we'll talk about those. I actually happen to think Elizabeth Warren is overrated as a politician. I think Bernie Sanders is a little overrated as a politician. Now, people are going to hate me for that, but if you actually look at the speech, I mean, Elizabeth Warren lost to Scott Brown in Massachusetts, a very liberal state. You know, I'm not quite sure how effective she actually is at making the case that Hillary Clinton wants to make in the fall. I think she's probably better as a second-tier surrogate as opposed to a VP pick, but you know, I've been wrong about that stuff before. Speaking of people who may not be the best surrogates, do we want to roll the Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
Let's see what happened on their way to Philadelphia.
Today, when just hours after calling for the resignation of DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she announced she'll resign following the Democratic National Convention. This after leaked emails suggested party officials were mocking the Vermont senator. The emails reportedly went as far to consider using Sanders' religious beliefs against his campaign and showed top DNC officials using their efforts to aid Clinton. Sanders was disappointed by the emails but said he wasn't surprised, as he warned a long time ago the DNC wasn't running a fair operation. He added the function of the DNC is to represent all of the candidates and to be fair and even-minded. Schultz's resignation comes one day before the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia begins.
So Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's head of the Democratic National Committee, Democratic Party, was roundly booed when she tried to address a preliminary meeting. She resigned but said, well, I'm resigning, but I'll give up my seat after the convention. She said she was going to gavel the convention open, and that didn't go over real well. She was absolutely, you know, mercilessly booed by Bernie Sanders and other supporters of, you know, different candidates and factions in the party. And she had to resign immediately. She was replaced by Donna Brazile, who is a longtime Democratic operative whose credentials are really in field organization. You guys may have seen her on CNN, other shows like that. You know, very classic, you know, looking black lady with beautiful hair. I could listen to her read the phone book. She's actually very...
She's got that silver hair down.
No, she's got a good look and a good feel. And immediately what Brazile did was immediately went out and apologized, not only collectively, she took responsibility as head of the DNC. She apologized to all the Sanders supporters for what had gone down, and then started calling up Sanders supporters and individually apologizing to them. So a lot of damage control. I think, from what I've heard, very effective damage control by Donna Brazile in the aftermath. So what happened? Well, WikiLeaks struck again. WikiLeaks dumped a whole series of emails from the Democratic National Committee that were sent out over the course of the primary process, many of them indicating that people at the Democratic National Committee not only didn't like Bernie Sanders, but were kind of actively looking to obstruct Bernie Sanders and his campaign. Where did the leaks come from? A lot of rumors out there that the Russians hacked into the DNC system and the Russians provided these emails to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks denies that the Russians are the source, although they don't really want to get too into it, because if they start denying person X, Y, and Z, it might mean that person A becomes apparent. The Democrats picked up on the Russia angle and said, ah, the Russians, right, want Donald Trump to be president. So the Russians hacked the DNC website and infrastructure, not the website, their communications network, took these out, held them until this point, and then released them right before the Democratic convention to embarrass Hillary Clinton, to pave the way so that Donald and Putin could work together in a way that would advantage Russia. I'm gonna diagram this later on my Madden Telestrator, but this story got picked up quite a bit. So part of the controversy is about the Democratic process, Democratic Party process being unfair, and Sanders saying, see, I told you it was rigged, look at these emails. And then another part of the controversy is, you know, hey man, the Russians are pretty good at this stuff. By the way, if this is true, not to say that, I believe two things. I believe the Russians did this, because I grew up in the Rocky IV era when this is what the Russians did, but that the Russians have this kind of insight into the American political process, I'm a little dubious about. Maybe they want Donald. I don't quite know why they want Donald over Hillary, but okay. That part of it, I'm a little confused about. So,
well, Assange actually, the founder of WikiLeaks, actually admitted that he waited about 6 weeks to release them. He wanted to have some timing because he didn't like Hillary Clinton. Because he saw Hillary Clinton as one of the people going after him for the WikiLeaks. And so he's like, I don't know what I'm going to get with Donald Trump, but I know I'm going to get with Hillary Clinton. And
supposedly Putin doesn't like Hillary Clinton either.
Yeah.
Right? He thought that the United States and Hillary in particular meddled in one of his election bids, although I didn't actually know he was really elected, but...
I mean, it's funny because for last time I checked, he keeps stepping down from positions, but still stays in power.
It changes the Constitution so that whatever position he's in is a position of power, which is, you know.
Yeah, so I think they're going to change the position. Whoever's in charge of the DMV is in charge of everything. I mean, again, if you watch those Russian driving videos, whoever's in charge of the DMV, they might need a new one. But one of the things that sticks out about this is that Julian Assange is trying to say, no, I'm just here for the truth, this and the other. I'm a victim in all of this. But he's openly stated, no, I'm using this as a weapon, you know, to go after people who I think are against my interests. So he loses some level of credibility there. Now, let's move back to the actual convention and kind of the fallout from this. And so what you saw really on the first day is an attempt to try to bring everybody together. And you saw from various Bernie supporters going out and trying to do this. So one person in particular is comedian Sarah Silverman, who made the following statement.
I will vote for Hillary with gusto. As I continue to be inspired and moved to action by the ideals set forth by Bernie, who will never stop fighting for us. To be a part of Bernie's movement, and a vital part of that movement is making absolutely sure that Hillary Clinton is our next president of the United States. Booyah, Baba Booey. Ridiculous. They made me cut off my speech and now we have to stretch.
Okay, so you see two things going on there. One, bad timing, because you hear they made me cut off my speech, now we have to stretch. That should have been picked up on the mic, but it's very clear that timing wasn't right. Two, Sarah Silverman was saying, look, I supported Bernie, I'm willing to support, you know, and I guess the argument is if Sarah Silverman says you're ridiculous, there might be something wrong here. It's an interesting attempt to do this on the first day. Now, again, as the first show pointed out, it calmed down, but really what was going on is they were positioned in a place where the cameras could pick them up easily. As the night went on, they got moved back to where the cameras couldn't pick them up.
Apparently the California delegation was really out of control, which is ironic because California voted for Hillary Clinton. So presumably the majority of delegates from California were for Clinton, but it was the California Bernie supporters who were just, you know, rocking the house, and they kept moving the California delegation further and further back. I liked Al Franken's attempt to turn a Bernie chant into a Hillary. It's Bernie, Bernie, it's Hillary. It's like, no, that's Bernie. I was listening pretty carefully. It was not a Hillary chant. And there's something about, apparently, if your initials are SS, so you've got Sarah Silverman, Susan Sarandon. If your initials are SS, apparently you're really predisposed to support Bernie. This was kind of hailed as a turning point in the convention. Sarah Silverman dressing down the delegates, the Bernie supporters. And, you know, this is overinterpretation as far as I'm concerned. You know, the idea that Bernie Sanders supporters who were so zealous in their support would say, oh man, you know, Sarah Silverman is right. I'm being ridiculous. I need to vote for Hillary. Come on. You know, that did not happen. What of course logistically happened was they were vamping up there because Paul Simon wasn't ready to go on and sing Bridge Over Troubled Water, which, by the way, the only thing that really would have worked on Monday night is if Art Garfunkel had come out to sing that with him, which would have showed reconciliation, right? Simon and Garfunkel coming together to sing Bridge Over Troubled Water. Eh? You see, I'm bringing this all back home. That would have really worked, but Paul Simon wasn't ready to go on. By the way, I love Paul Simon. I saw him at Bass about a month and a half ago. It was fantastic. But God, that was an awful rendition of Bridge Over Troubled Water. It's, you know, you need Art Garfunkel there to sing that song. You know, Paul, God bless him, he's 70 years old. He shouldn't sing that song anymore. But, you know, this is what happens sometimes at conventions. The Democrats notoriously go long on their conventions, and, you know, that's part of the charm of the Democratic Party is they're never on time. So Al Franken and Sarah Silverman, who were up there making the case that Donald Trump was unqualified to be president, Al Franken, former SNL cast member who's now in the Senate, making the case that Donald Trump is not qualified to be hold public office, I found kind of ironic. But I guess it's the presidency versus the Senate, so all right.
This is his second term, though, right?
Al Franken has been around a while, yeah. And you know has apparently a pretty good reputation in the Senate. You know, as a matter of fact, he's got a reputation for being decidedly unfunny in the Senate. He's a very serious guy, I guess now. But anyway, all that went on, and then
One thing that's important to note is a lot of people are saying that it wasn't as controversial as they were making out to be. Like there was a small cadre of people, so it weren't like there were fist fights breaking out. What you had is a small bunch of people who were able to get in a position where the mics and the cameras could easily see them, and it wasn't as cantankerous as the media wanted to make it out to be. But again, it's also the first day. And so what you do the first day is you yell, you scream, and then by the end, you're like, oh, I love you too, or you go home. And, you know, I think that's why the second day got calmer as night went on, as Professor Shaw pointed out, because of logistics. They moved them away. But I think by the second day, it got a little bit calmer because, you know, I think it became much more issue-focused, and, you know, it became a little more directed. Now, also what we've seen trying to reconcile this is Bernie Sanders came out the first night and endorsed Hillary Clinton. So let's hear what Senator Sanders comments.
It is no secret that Hillary Clinton and I disagree on a number of issues. That is what this campaign has been about. That is what democracy is about. But I'm happy to tell you that at the Democratic Platform Committee, there was a significant coming together between the two campaigns, and we produced by far the most progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party.
All right, so Sanders kind of, what he says there is, I got what I wanted. You know, I influenced the platform, I got Hillary to take on a set of positions that are consistent with my positions. The speech was probably pretty much what Hillary wanted. The Warren and the Sanders speeches, you know, kind of showed some interesting things. To me, they show why I think in some sense, I've made the case, I'm sorry to offend people, that they're sort of overrated in some sense, because the causes that they champion are passionate and popular. People sort of assume that they're, you know, really, really charismatic, telegenic speakers. They're really not. You know, Sanders and Warren spend most of their speeches Monday night reciting a list of policy positions that they're really excited about and committed to. And I'm not, you know, knocking that. I'm just talking about from kind of an energy standpoint, an optic standpoint. So the more Bernie's speech went on, the more you realize it was basically his standard stump speech. You know, break up the banks, free college, you know, the set of positions that have gotten people really energized about the campaign. But if you're following the live tweets, for instance, the reporters, and I think everybody who's heard this speech 100 times, you know, sort of says, oh, well, this is a standard stump speech. Well, nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I think the idea that they were going to electrify the campaign was probably overwrought. And, you know, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, their candidates, in Elizabeth Warren's case, Massachusetts, Bernie Sanders' case, from Vermont, who are appealing to very liberal constituencies. They do a very good job at that. But in terms of capturing the imagination of the nation, like Ted Kennedy in 1980 or Jesse Jackson in 84 or Mario Cuomo or even Arnold Schwarzenegger a few years back, you know, the other thing, I think they followed Michelle Obama, who gave a very effective, very subtle speech on Monday night, kind of contrasting, you know, her personal situation, using it to kind of talk about the country, the difficulties of a negative climate, you know, and really, I think, kind of skewering Trump in an indirect but extraordinarily effective way. I think, you know, for me, there was Michelle Obama's speech on Monday night and then everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody pointed out, Michelle Obama's the first person to speak at the RNC and the DNC in the same year.
Oh, I like that. That's good. That's good.
Now, I didn't see it as that indirect, and I was like, ooh, hot damn. I mean, it was basically, I mean, it was like a rap diss track, except she didn't name names. I mean,
right. That's so, what I mean by subtle.
Yeah, it was subtle in that sense, like we knew who she was talking about.
Right.
But yeah, it was that, and I think, and this has really been the way I painted Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, is they would be great bureaucrats. They'd be great if you put them in head of a department or something like that, or gave them an appointment, because they're really into these certain policy areas. But they're not going to get you excited. They're not going to have you ready to go out, you know, and do these things. Because they're
unless you're really down for the cause.
Yeah, unless you're really down for the cause, and you really know about the issue, you're down for it. But they're not going to, they're policy wonks. Yeah. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren was in law school, you know, so she is a policy wonk. She's not necessarily there to encourage you to get you. I mean, she's there to encourage you, but she's like, look, here's what's going on, here's what I want to do. But she's not going to give you that great speech from Hoosiers or from Rocky, you know, or those classic speeches you get from the football coach before, you know, your ragtag group goes out against the other team in the state championship, all right? But, you know, she's more about defensive coordinator, who's like, stay right here on this play. Do not let the person, containment, you know. So that's really the big issue there. Now, moving on from the DNC, we'll talk more about the DNC next week as we see Hillary Clinton's acceptance of the nomination, but also President Obama with his farewell speech, along with Harry Reid making his final appearance. And we'll also talk about the importance of the fact that this is the first time that a major party has nominated a woman for the presidency. And so this is, you know, this is an historic event. But let's actually talk about policy. And there's still a lot of policy things going on, in particular in regards to healthcare and health insurance companies. So we have a clip to show you.
And today, I'm announcing that the Department of Justice is suing to block both Aetna's acquisition of Humana and Anthem's acquisition of Cigna.
And with Thursday's announcement from Attorney General Loretta Lynch, the battle lines are drawn to stop a massive consolidation in the health insurance sector. The DOJ moving to block the two mega deals worth a combined $80 billion on the grounds the nation's big five insurers would shrink to just three, threatening to push premiums higher. Reuters health and pharma correspondent Caroline Humer says even though the DOJ denies it, there are some on Wall Street who think there's a whiff of politics at work.
the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services that runs Obamacare is very worried about competition in the health insurance market. They're worried that prices are going up for health care overall, for drugs. They want to keep things down.
But the insurance companies aren't taking this lying down.
Aetna and Humana put out a pretty strongly worded statement saying that they were going to fight this lawsuit. And we're hearing the same thing from Anthem and Cigna.
All right, so what you see going on here is this is an example of regulation, of where the U.S. government is stepping in to try to control business practices. And the reason why you see the federal government stepping in here is because they think that the merger of these companies will affect competition. And so where you have five major players in the insurance market, with these mergers, you'd end up with three. And what is also important to this is that with these mergers, that these companies get a larger share of the patient population, which means because they have a larger share, they have more negotiating powers when they meet with doctors and hospitals to negotiate rates. And so the fear here is that because they've gained so much power, they can lower rates in terms of lower payments to hospitals and doctors, while at the same time increasing premiums. And so this is kind of a fear of some type of collusion or monopoly to where you don't have good competition, and the lack of competition may actually end up hurting customers. But also in terms of the ACA and the marketplaces that they want set up, the marketplace is there for competition. But if you reduce the number of competitors, it kind of hurts the amount of competition you have. And so this is what's going on here. And this is kind of an important policy issue to talk about, because this is an example of, you know, regulation, of government regulation. We'll talk about this more as we get to the economic policy module, but this is a prime example of the federal government stepping in to kind of regulate business, specifically to protect, specifically under the argument that they're protecting consumers and trying to keep competition very strong. Now, along with that, we have some other issues, policy issues that have come up over the past week, specifically dealing with Texas.
Yeah, we got a voter ID decision came down. Y'all are probably aware, a couple of years ago, the Texas State Legislature passed a requirement that voters in the state of Texas present a photo ID in order to vote. And it was designed ostensibly to prevent or to reduce the possibility for voter fraud. That case was immediately challenged. What you need in Texas is pre-clearance, because Texas is still a suspect jurisdiction, suspect state under the Voting Rights Act. So Texas, when they make any change to the voting law, has to be pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. That pre-clearance was denied, which initiated a series of court cases between Texas and the federal government. The Fifth Circuit Court came out with a decision that basically, you know, ruled unacceptable Texas's voter ID law. And we have a clip, I think, that talks about some of the details.
A federal appeals court ruled Wednesday that Texas's strict voter ID law violates the Voting Rights Act and ordered changes before the November election. The ruling from the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals instructs a lower court to make changes that fix the discriminatory effect of the 2011 law, but to do so in a way that disrupts this year's election season as little as possible. President Barack Obama's administration took the unusual step of deploying the weight of the U.S. Justice Department into the case when it challenged the law, which requires Texas residents to show one of seven forms of approved identification. The state and other supporters say the Texas law prevents fraud. Opponents say it discriminates by requiring forms of ID that are more difficult to obtain for low-income African-American and Latino voters.
All right, so that's a little bit about the voter ID decision. We've got a slide that actually shows, under the Texas state law, the acceptable forms of voter ID if you're going to vote on election day. You can see there's seven different forms, including a driver's license, but also including passport, military ID, conceal and carry. What you notice is not on the list, government ID or student ID. I actually think, sort of a personal slash professional opinion, if Texas had included a government ID, a student ID, as part of the acceptable photo ID, I think this thing might have stood a much better chance of actually passing legal muster. But anyway, just a couple of comments on this. Texas has a strict, perhaps the strictest voter ID law. There's a series of states that have passed voter ID laws over the last 10 years, including states like Indiana, Georgia, North Carolina, right, Pennsylvania, some of them in the South, some of them in the North. And as a general matter, what you're finding is that the particular claim the government has raised is something we call disparate impact. And that is that the law will disproportionately affect at-risk populations of one sort or another. So in the case of voter ID, the argument is the elderly, who oftentimes don't have a driver's license anymore, not an acceptable driver's license. They have expired or they don't drive anymore. Racial and ethnic minorities, who are, according to all statistics, slightly less likely than whites or Anglos to carry a driver's license, right? That if that's the case, if those groups are less likely to have that form of ID, they might be less likely to have, you know, one of these seven forms of acceptable ID. Therefore, they're more likely to not be able to vote. Right. That's the argument the Department of Justice has raised. The other argument, I think, is more kind of tangential, and that is, but relevant, but sort of off the mark a little bit, that is that it's kind of a solution or a legislation in search of a problem. That is, there isn't a lot of evidence from the political science literature that there's much voter fraud going on. So anyway, what the court ruled is that, in fact, there is a disparate impact. What they asked the lower court to do is to go back and draw up an acceptable solution to this. So the thing has kind of been kicked back to the lower court. The law itself has been ruled, you know, invalid, but it's still in place. It's going to be fixed, presumably by November, because that's when our next election is, by some kind of lower court remedy. And that's what we're waiting on right now. So voter ID is kind of in limbo until the lower court chimes in on this. All right, we got one additional thing we want to talk about that today. So the Democrats have talked about unity and talked about policing and you know, I don't know about you, I was watching the ESPYs a couple weeks ago and saw Chris Paul and Carmelo Anthony and LeBron James talk about social issues in a way that, you know, athletes sometimes don't. One of the perhaps the most prominent athlete, certainly in my generation, Michael Jordan, who's oftentimes been, you know, kind of criticized for not being terribly socially active. Michael Jordan with the famous line, Republicans buy shoes too, has been kind of quiet on these things. But Michael Jordan actually has stepped up for one reason or another, said some things on some issues lately. So Professor McDaniel, you're part of the Jordan generation, right?
Yes, Jordan broke my heart many a nights. I was a Knicks fan of the 90s.
Ouch.
Yeah. So between Jordan, Hakeem, OJ, I still blame OJ for the Knicks losing in 94. Starks just couldn't deal with the stress. So Michael Jordan, who again, and the reason why Michael Jordan's caught a lot of flack for not standing out is in the, I want to say either late 80s, early 90s, there was a Senate race in North Carolina between black Democrat Harvey Gantt and white Republican and the incumbent, Jesse Helms, and there was a lot of racial tension, and people asked for Michael Jordan to kind of, hey, look, can you do something here because you carry a lot of weight in the state? His response is, well, Republicans buy shoes too, and it's kind of been seen as like, okay, you don't want to do anything. But you did see him when Bill Bradley ran in 2000. He came out and supported Bill Bradley, and what you're seeing going on right now is he's coming out in support of actions to improve police community relations. And so we gave $1 million to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And again, if you remember from Professor Shaw's discussion earlier about various ways of challenging for rights, the legalist strategy, that's where you see the NAACP Defense Fund coming into play. And so this is the legalist strategy and action and supporting that. But he also gave funds to a group that is specifically focused on improving police community relations. And so what you have going on here is a major figure stepping in to support the legalist strategy in the sense of providing help for legal remedies to what may be seen as police overreach, but also giving money to an organization that works with the police to improve these community relationships. And this has really been one of the big things that's in really many ways it's been changed, where it's no longer an issue of Black Lives Matter versus Blue Lives Matter, but police community relations. And I think this is the way a lot of the rhetoric you're seeing out of President Obama, who's trying to be a little bit more centrist, even though he clearly identifies with a lot of rhetoric coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement. He also is recognizing, you know, the needs of the police and saying we need to work on these relationships. And if you watch the town hall from a couple weeks ago, it was really about how do we improve these relationships, and by improving these relationships, we may be able to stop some of these things from happening. That when the police do use force, that the public does not automatically assume that it's a misuse of force. But then also, you may see a decrease in the use of force because the police have a better relationship with the community. And these are all various things and complicated things to deal with as we see these issues moving forward.
Yep. So MJ finally chiming in. $1 million to each of those organizations. I mean, you know, seems like a lot of money to me. May not be to Michael Jordan, but I'm never going to criticize somebody for $1 million donation.
$1 million than I gave.
Right.
$2 million more than I gave.
That's exactly right. So, so anyway, that's the tie-in. If you're wondering why we're talking about Michael Jordan, as Professor McDaniel said, it's a really interesting sort of in the broader context of how these issues, you know, things are changing, right? There's an expectation that athletes or celebrities, we've been talking a lot about celebrities today, right? Whether it's Donald Trump, sort of the major celebrity here, but Sarah Silverman, you know, Al Franken in the Senate, you know, this sort of activism on the part of athletes. And then, but the particular tie-in, that sort of embrace of a legalist strategy, or the relevance, I guess, of the legalist strategy as some of these issues come to the fore, I think is really kind of interesting.
Yeah, and so these are, again, important things to make sure we tie this back into the class. We hope you're enjoying this as you go along. But that's all we have for this week. Next week, we'll wrap up with the DNC and talk about some other issues that have come about. Have a good week.
Take care.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.